Rome has fallen, but it won't lie down. TV history commissioners love Vesuvius as much as they love the Titanic. In the last year on the screen, Ben-Hur rode again, and Netflix made it possible to binge on the story of the Emperor Commodus. A BBC article depicting black Romans became the source of a dispute between an American professor of statistics and one of our leading classicists. And Ben Carson, Donald Trump's rival and now a member of his cabinet, loves talking about ancient Rome. The Roman Empire was very, very much like us, he said. They lost their moral core, their sense of values in terms of who they were, and after all of those things converged together, they just went right down the tubes very quickly. Well, I guess he had to be right about something. Ancient Rome also haunts tonight's prom in the form of Respighi's Fountains of Rome and Pines of Rome. So that's our cue to explore what the Romans have done for us. Not the aqueducts, the sanitation and the roads, they go without saying, but the culture, the books, the films, the plays. And we'll do that with the help of the actor Peter Marinka and the novelist, critic and presenter of Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. Now, who could I be talking about? Oh, yes, Natalie Haynes. Natalie, those Roman stories never seem to leave us. Quo Vadis, Gladiator, up Pompeii. Are we still getting over Roman rule?
In a way, I think we are. I think there's the thing that's difficult for you, I think, if you're a classicist, is that the Romans have so many points of comparison with us that sometimes it is tempting to sort of forget the interstitial, you know, couple of millennia. And it feels like there's a toga party happening and our invitation is just lost in the post for now. And we're sort of halfway to a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, or halfway through a ridiculously rude double entendre with Frankie Howard. And actually, of course, it's an incredibly alien society, but the parallels are undeniable. And the our culture certainly owes more to the Greeks, our literary culture certainly owes more to the Greeks, but it's impossible to live here and now and not think that we owe huge debts politically, legally, yes, also culturally to the Romans, of course.
So how strong are these influences, do you think? Should we think of these stories as a kind of post-colonial fiction?
Perhaps we should. Yeah, perhaps we should. I mean, fiction is something which feels like a slightly later invention to me. But I suppose you could argue it. Why not? Let's give it a go. Let's go for Petronius as fiction and see how we get on. But yes, I think our construct of... I mean, Petronius is a beautiful example because it's a long piece of fictional prose. And the largest chunk we have, the Cæna Trimalchio, and it's the dinner party of Trimalchio, is a sort of horrible dinner party of a very rich, very vulgar man who has made his own money. And that kind of contempt is precisely what you see in, for example, Harry Enfield's Loads of Money. It is exactly the same thing. It is precisely the same contempt that we feel when we see Donald Trump in his golden lift, if you will forgive me for pointing it out.
But the literature that we produce, yes, about this period, does that suggest that we are still somehow getting over in the thrall of the Romans somehow, that they are a kind of immovable object as far as our cultural references are concerned?
I think that might be true. I think you can like them or hate them, you can kick against them, react to them, or, you know, follow on from them, but you can't really ignore them. And it's surprising how easily they mix into other things. So just off the top of my head, the Lindsay Davis crime novels, which are basically gumshoe novels, but set in Rome of the time of Titus, I think, or Domitian, just about. And so the late first century, latter part of the first century CE, AD, if you prefer your dates godly. And so, you know, you can mix a sort of urban Roman setting with what's basically a gumshoe star from Los Angeles. And it worked perfectly well. The Romans will stand up to it perfectly well.
Did we ever forget them since they left? Or have they been a constant presence since they left in British culture, do you think? Or
I guess the Dark Ages are dark for a reason. Yeah, I suppose the Dark Ages is a bit of a bleak time, Rome-wise, and obviously in many other ways, hence dark. And so we have to wait a while. And then, of course, when neoclassicism comes along, everything changes. You know, we suddenly... I mean, perhaps we overvalue them, and certainly the version of the ancient world that we see through the prism of neoclassicism, i.e. lots of beautiful white buildings when actually they would have been heavily decorated, you know, beautiful white statues when they would have been heavily painted. Of course, our vision of it is completely distorted, but still it pervades nonetheless.
What about you and the Romans? How far do you go back?
Oh, gosh, I started doing Latin when I was 11, which I'm afraid to say is ages ago. So, yes, rounding up to the nearest, you know, millennium, ages ago is the answer. So, yeah, no, the Romans have been part of my life for longer than I can really countenance. How is that possible? How is it possible that this has come true? And the Greeks since I was 15. So yeah, I was such a nerdy kid. I didn't have lunch money for about 4 years.
We're going to talk about how the Romans present themselves to us, how they presented themselves to each other, and how they perhaps continue to present themselves to us. So Peter Marinka is now going to read to us a bit of imperial propaganda from Virgil, and this is a translation by Seamus Heaney.
Now look this way. Take good note of this clan, your own bloodline in Rome. There is Caesar, and the whole offspring of Iulus, destined one day to issue forth beneath the dome of heaven. This is he whose coming you've heard foretold so often, August Caesar, child of the Divine One, who will establish in Latium, in Saturn's old domain, a second golden age. He will advance his empire beyond the Garamantes and the Indians, to lands unseen beneath our constellations, beyond the sun's path through the zodiac, away where sky-braced Atlas pivots on his shoulder the firmament, inlaid with glittering stars. Already the Caspian kingdoms and Maeotia know of his coming and begin to tremble at the oracles of their gods. The waters of the Nile quail in alarm and roil through their seven mouths. Not even Hercules pursued his labors over so much of the earth's surface, not when he stalked and shot the bronze-toed deer, silenced the boar in the woods of Erymanthus, and left the heir of Lerna vibrating to his bowstring. Not Bacchus either, careering in triumph, the vine reins in his grip, driving his tiger team down the heights of Nysa. So why should we then hesitate to test and prove our worth in action, or be afraid to stake and stand our ground in Italia?
Thank you very much, Peter. Now, Natalie, what is Virgil proposing there? What function does this speech have?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We're in the underworld, which is where all the best stories happen, and gives me the chance to use the word catabasis, which I always like to. A trip to the underworld, you're welcome. So when Orpheus goes, catabasis going down. So Aeneas goes down to the underworld in book 6 of the Aeneid in order to consult with his late father. Something you would, I mean, he'd only just died in like book 4 or something, book 3 maybe. It's like he could have really, this is a chat they could have recently had for a lot less trouble, is what I'm saying. But he goes down to the underworld, and his father, because he is now dead, can therefore predict this great future that Rome has ahead of it. So I chose this passage because it's seemed to me so interesting that this is being written by Virgil between 29 and 19 BCE. He dies in 19 and the poem is unfinished. It's taken him 10 years to write the 12 books. And he wants it destroyed, but Augustus forbids it because it is a great piece of imperial propaganda, which in no way reduces its brilliance as a poem. And so he's this piece that's written, you know, between at that point, 29 to 19 BCE, is then set way back in the sort of 12th, 13th century, the heroic age, and Anchises is predicting the future which will come, which just turns out to be the present when Virgil lives, which makes it much easier to predict. And so he's saying, basically, you know, this great race of Romans is going to be founded by you in the second half of the poem. Surprise. Spoiler, sorry, but there it is. And they will eventually be, you know, represented by this incredible man, this amazing figure who just happens to be Virgil's patron's patron. And that is, of course, the Emperor Augustus, the first emperor of Rome.
So everything was destined up to the moment that Virgil was writing.
The Romans love creating myth or sort of fitting them, the myth of their city, around myth that pre-exists. So in theory, Rome, as everyone knows, is founded by Romulus and Remus, right? And that happens, and then at the same time, it's also sort of founded indirectly by Aeneas coming from Troy. And so to sort of square the two things, they go, well, we must have had loads of kings. So we'll invent, how many got, what, 12? 12, that'll fill in the time. And they properly fill in the sort of 5 centuries they need, because because the city is founded, according to Livy, in, I think, 742 BCE, ab urbe condita.
So who's the audience of this? Who's he trying to persuade or big up?
That's a really good question, because some people would definitely have read this. It would have been copied by scribes. But lots of people would have heard it. You would have gone to a hall, a little bit like this one, to have heard perhaps Virgil himself read it. And Virgil is writing it for his patron, a man named Maecenas, whose patron in turn is the Emperor Augustus. And so this is for a very upper-class audience of people who are already not going to mess with Augustus, because that will turn out to be a terrible mistake in the time of Tiberius. So they're going to keep shtum and behave, but it's part of the branding exercise. Augustus is the great brander. This is how he does not end up executed on the steps of a theatre, because although he is just as much of a dictator as Julius Caesar was, he never calls himself a dictator, he never lets people think of himself as a king. He basically says, I have all the power of a consul and all the power of a tribune at the same time, sort of indefinitely. And that's fine, it's absolutely fine. They are normal powers, so he doesn't get assassinated.
And it still works, doesn't it? I mean, when Peter was reading that, I believed every word
I
of
know.
It. The Romans won the ancient info wars, didn't they?
Well, until the Christians, the Christians really won, because you only have to look at the enormous quantity of martyrdoms that people think happened. And actually, Christians get persecuted under Nero, under Domitian, under Septimius Severus, Diocletian, I think. But it's a tiny kind of burst. That's how Christianity, if the Romans had really... look how many Druids are left. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if the Romans had really gone for it, they had the chance. And actually, of course, history is always written by the victors. In the case of the Roman Empire, that's the Christian church.
It's also mainly written by men. But were there female voices in Roman literature?
There are. And most excitingly, at least for a British audience, the earliest example of women's handwriting anywhere in the world comes from Roman Britain. No, you're welcome. And it is from Hadrian's Wall. And it's very difficult to find, to ascribe value to this, because of course it's a society which isn't massively literate. And so literacy isn't necessarily a valuable commodity if you can afford a scribe. But this woman is like the camp commander's wife, and she is writing, or she has had her scribe write a message to her sister saying, please come for dinner. And then obviously the scribe has gone home, and she suddenly realises she wants to add something. And so she's written by hand, please come, my dearest heart, it won't be the same without you. It's just such a simple, moving message. So obviously women have a bit more power than they have in, for example, ancient Athens, where they are pretty much invisible and unheard. They can own businesses and things. But we don't have very many examples of women's writing, and one of those women is Sulpicia, whose work exists in, I think there are 6 poems. They're very, very short, almost epigrammatic, but they are love elegies, tiny, tiny love elegies. And they were, for a while, considered to be by Tibullus. They were in a collection of poems by Tibullus and friends, essentially, and for ages. It's exactly the history of scholarship that you'd hope for. For ages, Tacitus said, well, they can't be by a woman because they're too good. So they must be by Tibullus, actually. And then somebody said, oh, no, they're too unsophisticated. So I don't see... I suppose they could be by a woman. And then somebody said, well, they're very smutty, and I don't think a Roman woman could ever have thought such a thing. Yes, it's surprising how you can not understand how women are when everyone you know is 400 years old and a man at a university in the 1800s. But it turns out occasionally women have smutty thoughts and write poetry. I know, it seems ridiculous.
Well, Peter is now going to read Sulpicia for us.
My stupid birthday's here, and I'm supposed to go away and leave Corinthus here. What's better than the city? On the farm, it's cold and rustic, no place for a girl. Messala, uncle, you're thinking of me, but stop it. This is no time for a trip. Take me away, I'll leave my heart and mind in Rome. What good's free will? You make the rules.
Thanks very much, Peter. So, tell us a bit more about her. What do we know? The voice is so individual.
Yes,
what
it
do we
is.
Know of her?
She is born in perhaps the very late 50s or early 40s BCE. Her grandfather was the Rufus who is friends with Cicero. And her father is also, obviously, because this is the way these things go, called Rufus. And he and Cicero occasionally meet in the courts. But although they're often on opposite sides, they are friends. I think the ninth Philippic, I think it's right to say, is him proposing a sort of proper funeral for him. So they aren't enemies for sure. And here you can see her father must be dead and she must be unmarried, because her uncle, Messala, who is a great poetic patron, lots of poets are kept in business by him. You can't earn money as a poet very easily in Rome. You have to have a patron who pays you basically to sit at home and write. You're a kept man, or in this case, woman. And so her uncle is her guardian. So she definitely isn't married, or her husband would be, and her father must be dead, or her father would be. And so her uncle gets to decide where she's going to spend her birthday. And as you can see, she's following the traditions of love poetry. She's addressing it to her beloved, in this case a man, Corinthus. It's probably a pseudonym. That's the tradition of love poetry. So Catullus, of course, has his lesbia, who we think is a woman named Clodia, but he never calls her that. He goes for a metrically identical name, lesbia, and all the poets do that. It's a conceit of it, I suppose, because you shouldn't be having sex with somebody who wasn't your wife. So there it is. And so she is addressing her poem to Corinthus, but of course she has no power. If her uncle decides they're going to go to the country for her birthday, she can't say, well, I don't want to, and stay here. But what she can do, I think, is probably play her face, as we would say where I am from.
And there's a sequel to this.
That's what she does. That's poem two of the six tiny little poems. In poem three, she says, "Scis iter ex animo sublatum triste puellae, natali Romae jam licet esse suo, omnibus ie dies nobis natalis agator, qui nec umpenanti nunc tibi forte venit." She says, you know that journey that's been playing on your sad girlfriend's mind? Well, now she gets to spend her birthday in Rome. So we can spend the whole day together, and that good luck you were hoping for, bang, here it is. I paraphrase very slightly.
Beautifully done. Well, that's the Romans speaking about themselves. Now it's time to make their ears burn a bit and think about how others have seen them. So we must mention Edward Gibbon, the funky 18th century British historian who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And our next reading from Peter Marinka comes from that.
"If a man were called to fix the period in history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. The armies were restrained by the firm but gentle hand of four successive emperors whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect. The forms of the civil administration were carefully preserved by Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and the Antonines, who delighted in the image of liberty and were pleased with considering themselves as the accountable ministers of the laws. Such princes deserved the honor of restoring the republic, had the Romans of their days been capable of enjoying a rational freedom."
Thank you very much, Peter. Natalie, what does he mean about fixing a golden age?
Well, I suppose it's the great quest of history, or at least of that period of history, to try and work out sort of when the best thing was. Just as for a long time, philosophers puzzled over what the good life was, the best possible life was. I think the best time to be alive, well, the best time to be alive, if you are anything other than brutally a white man, is clearly now. I quite like having the vote. It's not been available to me for that long. I quite like being able to leave the house without having permission from someone. It's one of my favourite things I get to do, you know, do stuff. So it's not a question that I've ever asked myself. When people go, oh, would you like to travel back in time to ancient Rome? No, of course not. I would like to have rights, thanks. It's delightful. I'd like people not to be being crucified by the edge of the road. Another thing I like. So it's not a very difficult choice for me, but obviously for Gibbon it was a more puzzling matter.
And it's offered as a kind of model.
It is.
And he isn't the only person to offer this idea, isn't he? It has a long history.
It's seen as being a very desirable time, because obviously the first century of Rome is lots of, I mean, if we go by the historians that we have, so Augustus is okay, that time is okay, but there's been civil war up till then, so unless you were born immediately before him, difficult. And then Tiberius comes along and culls the entire senatorial class, at least if you believe Tacitus, who is profoundly biased in spite of his alternative claims. And then you have Looney Tunes Caligula, not a particularly fun time to be alive unless you are a horse and have political ambitions. And then you get Claudius. Well, you know, fun obviously for us lot, but then Nero, In which case you have to pretend to be dead to get out of one of his recitations, pretend to be giving birth if you are a lady, always worth a try, obviously. And then, of course, you get civil war. So none of it is... And then finally, after Domitian, you get this block of time where, you know, Roman Britain becomes quite a nice place to be. It's when Hadrian's Wall is built, for example, amongst other things. And so things are just a bit more stable. The threat of civil war has considerably receded. There's a sense of stability. The Roman Empire has expanded to about the sort of point that it's going to, and it's not anywhere near as acquisitive as it has been. And so it is a much more peaceable time to be alive, and people have a very luxurious life.
So the glory that was Rome is that period, and yet it's surrounded by...
malaise. Chaos.
You wouldn't necessarily want to model your society on. And
I
yet...
mean, not that many people die of old age. Do you know what I mean? When you read the accounts of, say, Tacitus, it seems like you can't believe anyone's left alive at the end of it. And actually, of course, he exaggerates. And so, you know, we're left with this very biased account. But it's very tempting, therefore, to kind of dwell on the relative comfort of the time after the time that Tacitus is writing about.
And it has such a romantic pull, and it certainly has a strong pull over British culture, and has had done for a couple of hundred years at the very least, or at least since the time when people were travelling to actually see the remains of Rome on the continent. Many of us encounter ancient Rome when we go exploring ancient ruins on holiday. I was in Tarragona in Spain this summer, and of course it was absolutely inevitable that I should have my photograph taken fighting my children in the amphitheatre.
I saw pictures of that, and it was excellent. I thought they were winning, though. I am sorry. You were bested by girls.
They were winning, yes. Charles Dickens wrote about this kind of experience, and very eloquently in his book Pictures from Italy. Peter.
When we came out of the church again, we stood nearly an hour staring up into the dome, and would not have gone over the cathedral then for any money. We said to the coachman, "Go to the Colosseum." In a quarter of an hour or so, he stopped at the gate, and we went in. It is no fiction, but plain, sober, honest truth to say, so suggestive and distinct is it at this hour, that for a moment, actually in passing in, they who will may have the whole great pile before them, as it used to be, with thousands of eager faces staring down into the arena, and such a whirl of strife and blood and dust going on there as no language can describe. Its solitude, its awful beauty, and its utter desolation strike upon the stranger the next moment like a softened sorrow. And never in his life, perhaps, will he be so moved and overcome by any sight not immediately connected with his own affections and afflictions. To see it crumbling there, an inch a year, its walls and arches overgrown with green, its corridors open to the day, the long grass growing in its porches, young trees of yesterday springing up on its ragged parapets and bearing fruit, chance produce of the seeds dropped there by the birds who build their nests within its chinks and crannies. To see its pit of fight filled up with earth and the peaceful cross planted in the center. To climb into its upper halls and look down on ruin, ruin, ruin all about it. The triumphal arches of Constantine, Septimus Severus and Titus, the Roman Forum, the Palace of the Caesars, the temples of the old religion, fallen down and gone, is to see the ghost of old Rome. Wicked, wonderful old city, haunting the very ground on which its people trod. It is the most impressive, the most stately, the most solemn, grand, majestic, mournful sight conceivable. Never in its bloodiest prime can the sight of the gigantic Colosseum, full and running over with lustiest life, have moved one's heart as it must move all who look upon it now. A ruin, God be thanked, a ruin.
Thank you so much. Dickens is really onto something there.
Yes, he is. Although I have the exact opposite feeling seeing that giant cross in the middle of the Colosseum. It properly breaks my heart. I feel like the Romans have been colonized by the church. It's like, how dare you? It's so offensive to me that you've put the sign of forgiveness in this space where people should be being murdered. Oh, wait, I am sorry, everyone. Sorry. I can't help it. It looks very antagonistic to me.
But the power of the ruin is something that draws us. And there's something about the fact that Rome has passed that is an important part of its appeal.
It's an extraordinary ruin, even by the standards of Rome, the Colosseum. I mean, it's sort of that thing where you kind of feel like it must be a cliche, like the Eiffel Tower or Big Ben, until you go there and realise that it is properly heart-stopping, you know, that you can walk up the steps that the Romans walked up, the actual steps, that they are worn away, but they are still there, and that, you know, yes, of course, lots of it is in, you know, not such good repair, but that you can feel that the sense of it being a place of terrible entertainment, you can absolutely feel it. And that sense, by the way, that people might be killed in a place of entertainment has in no way disappeared in this century, let alone any other time. Saddam Hussein used to slaughter people in football grounds, let's remind ourselves. So, you know, that sense of sport and murder for the collective societal good as perceived by the person in charge of it, that hasn't... I wish we had evolved past it. We have not. We are not as far from the Romans as perhaps we might be. But it's an incredible, potent place to go. And there is... It just is different. Reading beautiful Latin poetry reminds you what's brilliant about the Romans. Going to the Colosseum reminds you what's terrible about them, just horrific about them. They have no value for human life at all.
But must the Romans always submit to our agenda? You said that something about what you felt about going into the Colosseum and sort of seeing the Romans conquered. Dickens is using them as he wishes. So did Gibbon. Must they submit to us now?
I hope they don't. I hope they carry on, you know, refusing to at all times. I think they should always seem to us both intensely familiar and intensely foreign, intensely strange. They are not our neighbours across the ocean. They are our neighbours through millennia. We are exactly like them and nothing like them at all.
Let's take another example that I think demonstrates that point rather well. The television adaptation of Robert Graves's I, Claudius.
Classicist gateway drug.
Yes. We're going to play a little clip from this. And it's the moment when Augustus, who we all know as Brian Blessed, of course, has invited the Athenian orator Aristarchus to perform a recitation on the 7th anniversary of the Battle of Actium.
Caesar calls for silence.
What a noise.
Perhaps we should change places. Only the Romans can afford ushers with a voice like that. Did you have it trained?
I was an actor, sir.
Oh, that explains it. Resting, are you?
No, sir, I've given it up. Everyone's an actor in Rome. There just isn't enough work to go round.
And what there is goes to friends and relatives. It's the same everywhere.
The theatre isn't what it was.
No, and I'll tell you something else. It never was what it was.
Carlton Hobbs as Aristarchus, the Athenian orator, and William Bond as Caesar's usher from episode 1 of I, Claudius, directed by Herbert Wise. I, Clavdivs, we should call it really,
shouldn't
we? It is I, Clavdivs.
That's what it's called in my house. That's what it says on the DVD box set. That's what it is.
What does I, Claudius give us? Because I know what it gave Aaron Spelling, the producer of Dynasty. It gave him a model to work from.
Well, it's because Graves he translated Suetonius, I think, so he loved the gossip. Suetonius, of course, is the biographer of the 12 Caesars, but he is also out of time because he would have made the most brilliant tabloid journalist. If there is any even remote suggestion of sexual scandal, Suetonius is there like a pig hunting for truffles. He cannot resist it, ever. And so Graves had translated him and had got, therefore, this very kind of close, very biased, written, you know, decades after the facts, account from Suetonius. And so he has this amazing dynastic story to dwell on. But of course, then he, you know, I'm not sure the idea of a resting actor was entirely familiar at the time of Augustus, where actors, of course, were slaves or freedmen. If I were a senatorial woman and I married an actor, I would be bumped down a status class. That's how terrible actors were. Sorry, Peter. Obviously now everything is better.
Why is it so satisfying? Why is it so satisfying, I, Claudius, to see the Romans depicted in this way? Because The appeal of that series has not diminished.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It is incredible. I mean, the makeup looks rather, you know, stagey now and strangely opaque and sort of Play-Doh-y, but the power dynamics of it are absolutely compelling and always were. And I think that is the virtue of Suetonius, actually, which he is drawing on so carefully to create these monstrous characters who nonetheless we kind of can't help rooting for. We can't help it. You know, even as Caligula is mad as you like, we kind of, you know, he's a man who's assaulting his sister, he's going to murder her. It's a horrifying scene. And yet his madness is tragic. It's not just, you know, off-putting. And Claudius himself, as the narrator of the whole, of course, is, you know, it's an example of something we have achieved that the Romans didn't, which is to realise that people who have physical infirmity don't have mental infirmity. For the Romans, because he had a limp, then basically he was stupid. But actually, he was extremely learned and wrote volumes and volumes of history. Was obsessed with, I can't remember, Scythia, Parthia, somewhere like that, and wrote these very long and learned books about them. And so I think his, Jacobi just gives the performance of anyone's career, quite aside from his. It's anyone's, you know, high point and so early in it. And so we can't help but follow it. It reminds me, that clip especially reminds me, though, of Juvenal almost more than anything else. That bit in Satire 3, where Umbricius says, you know, what am I supposed to do in Rome? I never learned how to lie. It's like, yeah, everyone's an actor in Rome.
It's time to throw things out to you. Let's have you first, sir.
The great cultural achievements of ancient Rome. Was it because of or despite the mostly appalling political leaders of ancient Rome?
Well, I suppose I would have to say it was probably somehow because of, because generally all the best periods of creative history happen at a time when everything is terrible all the time, right? So the great Athenian experiment, they're at war the whole way through all those beautiful plays being written. They're at war with the Persians, or they're at war with the Spartans, or they're at war with the Sicilians and the Spartans, because why would you have one war, Athens, when you could have two and ruin a generation of men at a time? I don't know, keep going. And so it's intensely frustrating that I think we are at our most creative when everything is going horribly, horribly wrong. And therefore, I honestly can't tell you why we're not living in a golden age of creativity. But I feel confident that America in particular will be producing some magnificent work in the next, how many, 3 years, 5 months. And it's something to, it's the little victories, isn't it? That's the best we can hope for, is what I'm saying. But yeah, I don't know why the connection between a kind of sense of political oppression or a sense of lack of safety and making, perhaps people create things with a sense that they'd better do their best work because they don't know how long they'll have. But, you know, Sophocles managed to write, 150 plays throughout a time of war, and his family were weapons manufacturers. So he was doing very well out of the war. So I suppose for some people it works better than others.
But they wouldn't have had this kind of the way that we can moralise about the Roman Empire. Is that something that people did at the time? Did anybody make the kind of criticisms that a modern person might make of the society?
Yeah, well, they absolutely do. Depending on your perspective. So Tacitus, for example, is an unbelievably biased historian who opens his history, his annals, by saying he's going to write sine ira et studio, without anger or partisanship. And this is the biggest fib in all of Tacitus, who will go on to, for example, after the Great Fire of Rome happens in 64 CE, then Nero introduces Christopher Biggins, for those of us, of course, who are continuing with the I Claudius, I Clavdiv's theme. Everyone forgets it's Biggins. Christopher Biggins / the Emperor Nero sets up very good new building restrictions, that buildings should be slightly further apart, I think, but also that the bottom of them shouldn't be wood, it should be clad in stone, that you can't cook indoors. So things to stop fires starting and to stop fires spreading, which is the real issue. And Tacitus, I in no way exaggerate, Tacitus sort of throws away a mention of these building regulations and then mentions, of course, oddly, that Nero has built himself an enormous new palace called the Domus Aurea, the Golden House. And I swear to you, the chapter begins, in parts of Rome unfilled by Nero's new palace. And Tacitus is fantastic at criticising or putting criticism into the mouths of other people, criticising the Roman project. So most famously, of course, the words of Calgarchus, according to Tacitus, who is a barbarian, as the Romans would have perceived it, a chieftain. And he says famously, faciam solitudinem parcem Is that the right way around? Solitudinem faciunt, parcem appellant. The Romans create a desert and they call it peace. So would the actual barbarians, the non-Romans, have seen them in those terms? Perhaps, but certainly Tacitus thinks they did, and he's part of the senatorial class, so he is part of the system, critiquing the system through the mouth of an outsider.
Anybody else? Stick your hand up and the microphone will come your way. Is that a hand going there, sir? Yes.
Let's Otherwise, we'll have to just stare at you.
Yeah.
I'd like to know, I'm not a Tacitist, but I'd like to know what sort of influence the Greeks had. I mean, I've read quite a bit about the architecture, and I gather a lot of architecture in Rome was influenced by Greek classical architecture. But as a, I mean, it's a huge question, fairly obviously, but perhaps you care to comment on the sort of influence that the Greeks and the Greek learning had on Rome itself. I know you can't do it in 2 minutes, but just give us an idea anyway.
We'll give you three or four.
The Greeks invent virtually every literary form. I mean, they really properly do. They invent history, biography, philosophy, tragedy, epic, comedy, brackets old, comedy, brackets new. And so pretty much every possible literary form is invented by the Greeks. And then some of it is adapted or built on by the Romans, but very rarely do they exceed the Greeks, in my opinion. I love the Aeneid, but I wouldn't choose it over the Iliad or the Odyssey. I mean, I might choose Book Four. Book Four is beautiful. Dido and Aeneas it's the high watermark of epic poetry. But as a whole poem, the Odyssey is so complicated and strange and all about narrative. And you know, Homer isn't, whoever Homer is not having to write for a patron in the way that Virgil has to. You know, Cicero is the most brilliant orator of the ancient world. Is he the greatest writer compared with, say, Demosthenes? Difficult. And so the Greeks invent all these literary forms and the Romans always value them. But they have a very kind of strange love-hate relationship with the Greeks. So they conquer Greece, but it is always the language of culture, always. And so if you have, for example, any pretensions to an education in Rome, you would have to be able to read and speak Greek. And it is part of high society. There's a fantastic, it's always Juvenal for me, but there's a fantastic snide remark that Juvenal makes, I think in Satire 6, probably, because it's about women, where he's moaning about sort of smart society girls talking casually in Greek. Zoe kai tsuke, they say, my life, my soul. And he's appalled that they could be so snootily educated. But of course, the Greeks cast an incredibly long cultural shadow, and you're absolutely right, architecturally, that's true too. You know, the absolute beauty of a plain Doric column or a slightly more ornate Ionic column, and then, you know, eventually you get to the Corinthian, I don't like it as much. So the Romans are very good at really practical things. They also write, you know, some wonderful speeches, they write wonderful poetry. Love poetry is something that the Romans do fantastically well. Do they do it better than Sappho? Don't know, hard to say. We've only got three of her poems and a bunch of fragments because all of it was destroyed by the Christian church because a lady liked other ladies and that could not be allowed to happen. As we all know, it's never true. And so the Romans both have this huge debt to the Greeks and are sort of slightly embarrassed by their cultural inferiority. They have a cultural cringe. Is that what I want to say? And people have drawn parallels between the Romans' attitude to the Greeks and the Americans' attitude to the British. And it's not a particularly good parallel, but you can see why they started with it. You know, it doesn't follow through, but you can see why people have this notion of us as the sort of, you know, faded colonial power who are very high-minded. If you go to, you know, California or somewhere, then it doesn't matter what your accent is. People basically think you are out of Downton Abbey. You are pretty much the same as being the Prince of Wales. If you go virtually anywhere in America, it doesn't matter where you're. And so there is that sense that we must somehow be high-minded because we're British. And of course that isn't true. But it's, you know, I mean, obviously it's quite nice to be able to pass as that for a few minutes. Yeah, oh yeah, no, I quite like being high-minded. But I can only urge you, of course, to read some Greeks and have a lovely time, or go and see a Greek play.
Is there any more before we let our company disperse? Yes.
I just wanted to say, when I was at school and I had to learn Latin and Greek, we used to call the Romans the Americans of the ancient times.
Did you? Because yes. They were the only superpower of their time.
And they did everything grander and bigger and outdid the Greeks.
And they have really big roads. Yeah. I mean, that's just true.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. But yeah, I mean, there are definitely parallels. It's undeniable. But, you know, I'm always drawn to the parallel with the ancient world. I can never resist them. But I, you know, of course there are limitations. And it's really tempting. There's something so... And the Americans love it. You know, they love having a capital. And if you go to a university like, I don't know, Emory in Atlanta, the kind of Roman nature of the buildings and things like that, it's absolutely undeniable. They very much see themselves, I think, on a kind of continuum. But, yes, I suppose it's a thing we have to interrogate.
I'm afraid our time with the Romans is over now. I believe the Vandals and the Visigoths have use of this room next. So before they start banging on the door, let me thank Natalie Haynes and Peter Marinka and all of you here at Imperial College. Thank you.